It's time for Good Health, an opportunity to hear from our local healthcare community about the most current medical topics and how they relate to your healthy lifestyle. Good Health is brought to you by Good Shepherd Healthcare System. Now let's welcome our host, Nick Bejarano.
Hello and welcome to the Good Health Radio Show, sponsored by Good Shepherd Healthcare System. I'm your host, Nick Bejarano. Today is Dr. Matthew Carlson, urgent care physician who recently joined Gifford Urgent Care, located at the Columbia Professional Plaza in Hermiston. Welcome to the show, Dr. Carlson. If you have any questions while you are listening to Dr. Carlson and I this morning, please give us a call and feel free to ask any questions that you might have. Our number is 541-567-6500. That's 6500. And Dr. Carlson, I just kind of want to lead off with something so people can get to know you a little bit better here. For those of our listeners who may not know you yet, you recently were recognized as a hero by the media in Tri-Cities, Washington, for your selfless act of jumping into action to help save the life of someone in an accident and in distress. So what happened?
So it was a normal morning, as any truly great events start out as, that I was driving into work, and there was an individual who had a low-speed collision with a light pole. It looked like he was intending to take a left-hand turn, and then something had happened, and he drove directly into the light pole. There were individuals on the scene already that had acted and had moved him from his vehicle to the ground. And when I first saw them, they were actually doing chest compressions. And it didn't click in my head that that was actually happening, because you look around a normal street and you don't think about people standing on the side of the road doing chest compressions, doing CPR, administering aid. There were no emergency services there yet. And so I actually drove by and I'm like, wait a second, that was people doing CPR. I should probably go back. So I turned around, got onto the scene, and as I said in on news reports and in the paper, the Herald, is that my actions there were helping and directing more than anything else, because the individuals that got there first on scene, that took that initial risk, that took that step forward to help a fellow citizen, they did the big act. Mm. Because they chose to step out of their comfort zone. And I've been a paramedic. I've functioned within emergency medicine. I work as an emergency physician. I've done this stuff. And it was those people that had trained to do it in CPR classes across their entire careers. It was those people that had experience through volunteer organizations that made them want to step forward and help. I would say they're more the heroes in that situation because of the fact that they took that initiative.
That's awesome. I mean, it's great that you went back to help and to check on the individual and make sure that they didn't need anything else. And it sounds like they did a pretty good job from your perspective.
Oh, everything about that, not that you ever want to be part of a situation like that, because there is an emotional toll to stepping in with that, but every part of the system that is set up with emergency services of early recognition of someone that needs help, of getting emergency services to them, of having trained individuals in the community at large, everything in that situation worked as it was supposed to for the individual who had the medical emergency, which allowed everyone and the best possible outcome for that guy.
Awesome. And then from what I understand, after he was taken to Cadillac, he ended up doing pretty well.
I haven't been able to follow up, to be totally honest, because it would be that famous thing that a lot of people have probably heard about, HIPAA.
Yeah.
Because I'm not actively involved in his care, it would be inappropriate for me to follow up. Now, if somebody out there knows something and they want to reach out, I actually would be interested, because again, when you leave your place in that chain of survival from the patient, it is reassuring to know that the next link happened and the next link happened. And so that it gives you not only faith because you trained within it, but then knowledge that your actions did do something.
Awesome. So bringing us back to today, you recently came to Hermiston to work at Gifford Urgent Care. So what attracted you, and what was the draw to Hermiston?
So as I'd mentioned, I had been a paramedic in the past,
And during my 16-year tenure doing that, I had experience within rural areas in the state of Virginia and the state of Wisconsin, and also in the state of Minnesota. And so growing up in a town of 20,000 people, South St. Paul, Minnesota, go Packers, in case, anyways, sidebar. But in that scenario, I had a lot of experience with individuals in those communities, in that setting. And after doing metropolitan medicine, after working at a medical school, after working in an emergency department within a more a bustling community, as in, again, metropolitan, when I was looking for a change and knowing that I needed a change, rural settings seemed to be more genuine and honest to the way that I wanted to practice medicine.
Wow, that's really awesome. And, you know, just for our listeners that might not understand, what exactly is an urgent care?
So an urgent care is set up, originally when they first developed the idea of urgent care, it was partly to bridge that gap between a primary care setting. So, you know, a physician that would see you, would know your entire family, would sometimes deliver children, would sit by people on their deathbeds within families and within communities, to bridge that gap in between that setting and the emergency department, trying to take some of that pressure off of the emergency department. Because in, as many people know, when you go to the emergency department, they provide care for people that are in life-threatening situations. And to take some of that pressure off of them and get that into a different setting so that within the urgent idea, we can do take care of sore throats, we can take care of bronchitis, we can help people who need minor surgical procedures like suturing or skin biopsies. And again, that intermediate level with procedures then allows both the primary care to do their job and not feel overwhelmed by sometimes stuff that's outside of their scope, and then also to take some of that weight off of the emergency department.
Oh, that's a really good point. I know that here in our setting, we have kind of a lack of primary care has kind of been the norm. You know, we don't have enough primary care physicians for to treat everybody. So having, you know, the urgent care available for treating those, I guess, higher acuity things, but not as acute to go to the emergency room, is kind of that great bridge between both.
Most definitely.
Okay.
The difficulty with primary care with family physicians is actually not just for rural communities. It's actually a national
shortage, I
guess,
that's happening.
Using the term crisis, because it really is, where people need to see a physician, and sometimes they're waiting 2 months, and it's very difficult to say to somebody who has a sore throat, no, we're going to schedule you in April.
I could see that being very frustrating for a patient, for sure. So I understand you also have abilities similar to an ER that allow you to get back to the patient with results. So, if, for example, an X-ray, you have that available, and you also have some lab services available. What are you all able to do with those modalities or services?
So that's totally correct. We do have on-site X-ray that allows us to do basic imaging of the human skeleton. We do have limited amount of studies that we can do in that manner, but it also allows us then to have real-time feedback for patients, to where if they come in and they have, you know, they were on a scooter and they decided to experiment with gravity and gravity won, because it always does, and they ended up with a wrist injury, we're able to splint that person, but at the same time be able to then take an image and say, yes, you have a fracture, yes, this is a sprain, and then to be able to facilitate them kind of in a way that primary care did, but to get them then out to specialists who then, with their primary care, can continue their care. We can do basic laboratory studies. We can work with people who are having symptoms of a urinary tract infection. We can do, if someone has an abscess, we can actually open and drain that abscess in the setting and then start antibiotic therapies and be able to, again, be that kind of bridge to where someone in a more intense need for a procedure like an incision and drainage is able to get assistance and get those medications that they need.
Awesome. So we do have a question from a caller. And the question is, can a patient call to get on a wait list?
So right now at the it's not so much a wait list. We start taking patients at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. We also have hours on Saturday. But during the traditional work week of Monday through Friday, when you call in, we usually end up giving people an idea of what it's like for people showing up at the door. And so normally we have about 10 to 12 people that are waiting at our door at 8 a.m., and then our traditional appointment setup is usually around 15 minutes.
Okay.
Then we kind of extrapolate that out throughout the rest of the course of the morning and into the afternoon. People are able to come in, get signed in, get checked in, and if they have to, in some situations, like go pay a bill, run to Walmart, take their child to daycare, they can come back then. And they've kind of reserved their place in line.
So they don't lose their spot, essentially.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that's good to know. Another question that we did receive is, do you offer sports physicals in the office?
We do offer sports physical, but we're trying to keep it to a point of where we're not doing a lot of them, specifically for the reason that with a sports physical, sometimes it can be a little bit more time-consuming. I've done many of them so far with being here since October 31st. Yes, my first day was on Halloween. but it's one of those things of it's an expectation that if you come in for a sports physical and somebody comes in and they're short of breath or somebody mm-hmm. comes in and they have a fever, you may be asked to wait a little bit so that we can help that person who is actually physically ill.
So that's you bring up a good point there. And I guess my question around that is, do you or does the office prioritize based on need? So if they see somebody coming in short of breath or they see somebody with a huge laceration, does that bump the person that might have a cough?
Most definitely. We okay. want to make sure that the basic idea of all of medicine is to first do no harm. And in a situation, if you're having somebody who's there and has had a cough for a week, and we understand that that is a medical concern for that person, and in no way are we minimizing that person's experience with their illness. Right. But we also asked that the person who has that cough understand that if somebody's coming in and they're complaining of chest pain or they're really short of breath, or in the example that you gave where they have a very large laceration, then we do bring that person immediately back. We triage them. We figure out if they need and we can service their needs at the urgent care, or if we need to refer them primarily over across the street to the Good Shepherd Emergency Department.
So that brings up my next question. How do you determine if it's something that you can treat versus something that needs to be escalated to the emergency department?
It's basically if it's life-threatening or not, or okay. if we have the resources within the clinic to be able to help that person. If you're looking at somebody who, I mentioned the idea of chest pain, and this would be a chest pain that's of cardiac nature, of someone having like a heart attack. We do that triage and we're able to recognize that if that is the question, we're going to send that person to the emergency department because they need the advanced imaging. They need the advanced skills, the advanced diagnostics that we just can't provide within an urgent care setting.
You're listening to Good Health on KOHU, and today I'm talking with Dr. Carlson, urgent care physician. If you have any questions, give us a call at 541-567-6500. Again, that is 541-567-6500. Switching gears a little bit here, I know from talking with you that medicine was not your first career path. In fact, this isn't your first time on the radio either, is it?
No. A long time ago in a land far, far away, beautiful, great state of Minnesota, go Gophers, was at the University of Minnesota that I had the opportunity to work with the student radio there. And very similarly, it was a Thursday morning gig, and that was back in the days when we were still spinning vinyl.
And you mentioned to me at one time you also were one of the first stations to actually play a hit song. At one time.
That was more related back to the fact because we were in that student setting.
Ah, okay.
We had a direct connection to that music scene, if you will.
Okay.
And so the individuals that were in the band, they brought it, and they were like, hey, you guys should play this. And we're like, hey, that's great. And we put it on the air.
Do you remember what it was?
God, actually, to be totally honest, I don't recall.
That's all right. So what was your first career path?
Originally, when I went to the University of Minnesota, it was originally to be for secondary ed for English teaching. So I wanted to be a high school English teacher.
Okay. And you did teach English for a while, from what I understand, right?
Well, I started taking my student teaching classes at the University of Minnesota, but at that same time, totally by happenstance, I ended up taking an emergency medical technician, an EMT class. It was for another gig because I was doing loss prevention for a Renaissance festival back in Minnesota. And my ability to do what I wanted to do with that organization was to become a first responder. I went to the first responder desk, and it was actually totally full, so I couldn't take that class. But amazingly enough, the table right next door to it had an open spot in their EMT class. And so some great things happened by strikes of lightning or by design. I would like to think that this was a little bit of both.
Awesome. So in talking with you, I also understand that you're a movie aficionado. So tell us a little bit about that.
I prefer the term geek, but movie aficionado works. During my time with doing my first degree, which was in English, I had the opportunity of studying America film genres. And so within looking at films, of looking at the scripts and the way that the directors utilized it in very the same way that when you look at like Shakespeare or you read Dostoevsky, it's that taking that text of the film in the context of the time that it was written and then looking at how they crafted the image and how they used their skills with the film, the lighting, the music, the dialogue to create that. And many people will challenge me on the idea that film as a whole is an art form, because many films really, really strain that perspective of saying that they're art. Mm-hmm. But in the way that they are constructed, the same way that a sculptor would do working with marble, the directors work with the film genre in what used to be celluloid and, of course, now is digital medium.
Sure. So what's your favorite movie and why?
Oh, my favorite film. I would actually, because I'm a huge science fiction, I'd all the way back to watching Star Trek when I was a little kid on TV, because that was something that I actually engaged with my older brother and my father in doing. I would have to say the entire Matrix series. And part of the whole reason why is that when we look at the incredible technology advances that we are having, even within my limited time on this planet, of the human toll and the human perspective within a construct that is not necessarily human. And the choices that people are making, and sometimes people that are very lonely in those situations of where their digital life becomes their life. And so I thought that in the allegorical way that they did within The Matrix, kind of got at that idea. And although we should learn from some of our art, I think that with the pervasiveness of media into our lives, our phones, that sometimes we miss that need for human beings to actually associate directly with human beings and to treat media as a pathway, not necessarily a destination.
Very interesting. Yeah, I know from just, you know, doing my own research and reading and whatever else that, you know, today in society, media is definitely taking over our lives in obvious ways, you know, whether it's our cell phone or computer, and we're spending more time hunched over on things. So are you seeing people with a lot of neck problems because of that come into urgent care?
So as a DO, a doctor of osteopathy, during my medical training, we, along with traditional medicine during my 4 years of schooling, we also added in physical medicine and manipulation. An osteopath looks at a patient from the perspective of a mind, body, and a spirit. And so within that triad, knowing that when anything is off in that three, it's going to cause difficulty for that person and dysfunction. And one of the ways that we can help people, not just by giving them a medication, an anti-inflammatory, although those definitely do have their places, is by changing the way that the body is moving, the inherent motion of the body, removing hurdles to that patient so that they're able to be more active, alleviating pain. And also then by our knowledge of the human biomechanism, because it's very similar. We want to try and separate it, but it's very similar engineering-wise to, you know, any complex mechanism. And so if you can help somebody to be able to maximize their enjoyment of life, getting out and being with family, being active, reducing pain, definitely that is my goal. And yes, looking down at TV screens, looking down at phones. I've actually seen patients who are 13 and 14 and are starting to develop early arthritis at the base of their thumb.
Wow.
And there's actually a medical diagnosis, which amazes me, called gamer thumb.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not.
Wow. So you kind of touched on something that I wanted to bring up a little bit more. And you mentioned that you're a DO. So what's the difference really in philosophy, I guess, or in layman's terms, from a DO and an MD that our listeners might not know about or that might be interested in? You touched on it a little bit, but could you expand on that?
So my brothers and sisters in the medical field that are MDs and DOs, we both have the basic medical training that is very, very similar. It is often a perspective difference that originated back when osteopathic medicine was first brought about, with the idea that the body has an innate ability to heal itself, mm-hmm. and that our job as osteopathic physicians are to remove hurdles in between the person and that natural state, which is health. Now, that brings up ideas of preventative medicine, and both osteopaths and traditional allopath, which is what we call MDs, allopathic medicine, mm-hmm. Both sides of that fence were heading in the same direction. It's just a slightly different perspective on how to get the patient to that point.
Okay. So what tactics or techniques, I guess, do you use as a DO versus what an MD traditionally might do to get them to that point?
So both MDs and DOs work with preventative medicine.
Sure.
They work with the patient in doing lifestyle modification, because we know that, you know, we are what we were. Choices that we make in our lives very often affect our health status. I tend to try and move towards, as an osteopathic physician, not necessarily reaching for the prescription pad first, mm-hmm. of, you know, could this person be helped out along with, like, a ibuprofen, physical therapy. Would they benefit not with choosing an antidepressant, talk therapy, or even a thing which is called gratitude journaling, where we work with people that are experiencing depression to help them be more mindful of those things in their life that they are grateful for. Hmm. And there's actually pretty strong data just with gratitude journaling that doing that as a practice, independent of talk therapy or independent of medication, can actually significantly improve mood during the course of the time that they're using that technique.
Wow. So I guess another question for you is, when you became a doctor, what path of medicine did you pursue? I know you talked a little bit about being in urgent care and ERs. Is that kind of where you've always been? Is that what you wanted to do?
On the fourth year of my medical school, so just a quick explanation, within medical school, you do 2 years that are really hard book study. The second 2 years are what we call our clerkships. And so where you go out and you do those things and you get experience in those areas that you have passion towards. So if it's surgery or if it's family medicine or emergency medicine, or pediatrics, you do that, like, focus kind of in your second 2 years. When I ended my medical school career, I was torn between wanting to be a hospitalist, wanting to be a primary care family physician, and wanting to do emergency medicine. Hmm. And you really can't do all three at the same time if you want to maintain your sanity. And so my sanity and my relationship with my lovely wife, really important to me.
Right.
And no, honey, I did not put those in any particular order.
Just in case she's listening.
Just in case she's listening out there, and I do need to go home tonight. And in that idea, then, I found that family medicine allowed me to do what we like to call cradle-to-grave medicine, so where you are able to work with individuals very often, even prenatally, or with counseling on reproductive health, all the way to end-of-life decisions, hospice, that kind of thing. And it was in that same vein that it allowed me to do procedures because I like to do procedures. It allowed me to have that acuity where sometimes you will see sicker patients that being a primary hospitalist didn't allow me to do. I get experience with dealing with patients for kidney concerns, for areas of respiratory disease, of metabolic diseases like diabetes. And so I found that family medicine was that one place that actually allowed me to kind of engage that part of my brain of short attention span theater of saying that, yes, this is something that I can do a lot of stuff and help a whole lot of people in a whole bunch of different areas.
Wow, that is really, that's really cool. So I understand that you also continued to teach or pursue teaching as a medical student. Is that correct?
Yes.
Or when you actually graduated in teaching medical students, I guess.
Yeah. So I was very lucky to be able to be associated with Touro University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Henderson, Nevada. And through my relationship with them, I was able to work with residents and medical students in both a clinical setting and in a academic setting of lecturing as a guest speaker. It allowed me, and again, I've been incredibly blessed and incredibly lucky in my career field that I've been able to bring back the stuff that I originally started with in my, you know, advanced education and brought it back in my formal professional career as a physician to be able to still teach. And I find that that part of being a physician is actually part of our sacred responsibility to the community and also to the next generation of physicians is to take our expertise and be able to impart that to the next group of physicians. Because amazingly enough, we're not going to be here forever. We have a limited time on this planet. And so that ability to then pass on our knowledge, I feel incredibly blessed that I was able to do that and continue to teach both with medical students and residents.
Awesome. So you're listening to Good Health on KOHU, and joining me today is Dr. Matthew Carlson from Gifford Urgent Care. If you have any questions, give us a call at 541-567-6500. Again, that is 541-567-6500. I know just from talking with you that you bring a lot of uniqueness to the practice to make patients feel more comfortable and at ease when they're with you. And one of the things you told me about was Bowtie Tuesday. So tell us a little bit about Bowtie Tuesday and what that is and how it got started.
So Bowtie Tuesday was originally my rebellious nature coming out because I really didn't like wearing regular ties. Going into an exam room with a, you know, a big long piece of fabric right on my front and leaning over a patient or leaning over a lab sample, ties are, to a certain point, they can look cool, and if you're very conscious of your tie, but that tie can become a problem because if it sweeps through something, then you go see your next patient, and then you're bringing whatever you swept your tie through to that next patient.
Good point.
So I found that happy medium with a bow tie, and then I looked at it, and I'm like, do I want to be that guy that wears a bow tie all the time? And I was just randomly searching on YouTube, and I found a video of a gentleman who worked for a company that actually was using Bowtie Tuesday as a promotional thing.
Okay.
And so that kind of allowed me then of where on Tuesdays I was able to wear the bow tie. I got to express myself in my rebellious nature of saying, no, I'm not going to wear a tie. I'm going to wear a bow tie. And so it worked out really well. I actually had patients back in Las Vegas who, when I didn't wear a bow tie on Tuesday, they were like, Dr. Carlson, where's your bow tie? And then one day I actually ran out in between my patients because there was a store that was relatively close by, and I actually purchased a bow tie.
Awesome.
It was a pink hibiscus because that's all they had left.
There you go. So how many bow ties do you have now?
I did an entire year of bow ties, and so I've got somewhere between 50 and 60 of them.
So a different tie, bow tie, every
Tuesday. Every Tuesday.
Wow, that is really cool. So you also have a guiding principle and mantra that you kind of shared with me as well that you tend to live by and incorporate into your practice. Can you share that with us?
Yes, it was actually something that I had learned from, among all things, from a large animal vet. During my medical training, I wanted to be able to work with patients who necessarily couldn't actively communicate with me, and I wanted to extend my experience that way. And so I actually rounded with a large animal vet who primarily saw horses. He was an equestrian. And so with going around, he imparted to me, his name is Dr. Tom Hargrove out of Texas, and Tom imparted to me the idea of finding joy in those that seek my help. And with working with very large animals that could easily stop my butt without even thinking about it, the ability to pick up on intangibles, things that aren't necessarily verbally communicated, unless you're Mr. Ed, horses can't really speak. but they do speak volumes by their posture, by the positioning of their ears, by the tension in their bodies. And in that idea of, for every person that came to me, and to be able to find the joy in that service was something that Dr. Tom, I found incredibly impressive in his private practice, and then also that I was very grateful to be able to bring to my practice with the mammals that I choose to help out, which happen to be the species of humans.
Absolutely, because obviously not all humans can probably verbalize or really share what they're really experiencing or going through. And they could be going through a lot more than what you can actually physically see or what you're physically treating.
Most definitely. That goes into the ideas of the intangibles. Their relationships at homes, their relationship at work. For many people, going to see a physician has a very high emotional burden that's with it of, you know, what is this physician going to tell me? Are they going to tell me something that is going to alter my life? Are they going to tell me that I need to be on a medication? Are they going to give me a hard time because I smoke? All of those things bring their own weight into the encounter with the physician, and any provider, be it a nurse practitioner, be it a PA, be it a nurse on a floor. And I find that having an understanding and an awareness of those intangibles helps me again to get that person back to their natural state of being, which is health. Because a lot of times I've had patients yell at me. Mm-hmm. I've had patients degrade me. I've had patients that quite literally call in to question my relationship with other human beings. And I won't go any farther than that. But in those settings of remembering that it's taking my ego out of it and it isn't about me. It is about that patient and that patient's experience with whatever is impacting their life.
Wow. That's actually pretty profound and definitely something all of us need to think about when we go to the doctor and how we communicate and how we communicate with the physician, for sure. So, Dr. Carlson, I just want to thank you for joining me on Good Health Today. Dr. Carlson is an urgent care physician, part of the Good Shepherd Medical Group. He's practicing at Gifford Urgent Care, and his office is located at 1050 West Elm at the Columbia Medical Plaza in Hermiston. And his office can be reached at 541-567-2995.
Thanks for having me, Nick. It was great.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org. And I know